Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is the Somerset-born chef who has opened critically acclaimed restaurants in London and has made a remarkable return to his West Country roots with the opening of Holm in South Petherton. Nicholas Belf brings a love for seasonality and local produce to the restaurant, which has charmed locals and visitors alike. Holm is inspired by nature and its surroundings, and the team is driven by provenance, sustainability, and warm hospitality. Nicholas is also a firm believer in creating a progressive team environment, challenging the legacy that the food and drink industry has had in the past. We met in February 2023 and recorded our conversation on site at Holm. Nicholas, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for hosting me here. We're at Holm. Before we get into the restaurant and all that jazz, we just had half term. I know you've got a young family. So What types of things have you been up to in the area?
We actually managed to ship off our kids to grandparents and, sort of all around the country. And in fact, we managed to spread them across. Well, my two kids went to my parents' house in Dorset, and my stepdaughter went to Lisbon, actually, with her dad and her grandparents on that side. We were hoping for some pasta de nata, but we didn't get any, unfortunately. But we did get 3 days of no childcare and therefore nose to the grindstone at work for my partner and I. I'm kind of running this place and she has her own business as well. So it was actually kind of a strategic decision to get lots of work done.
Do you have a couple of hidden gems around the area, places that are sort of your go-to if you need to get out and about?
We really like going to Ham Hill, actually. That's one place that we go to all the time. We live in South Petherton now, but we used to live in Odcombe, so that's right kind of on the hill almost. And we love going for walks along the Ham Hill Country Park, which is stunning, and then up to the quarry at the top. And St. Michael's Mount, it's just a really beautiful place to go and quite handy for us, even now, still in a short distance away. So that's one place we go to a lot. And if we want to go a bit further afield, we tend to go to the coast, actually. We tend to go south. My parents are there, as I said. But we chuck a load of stuff in the back of the car and head down to normally West Bay or sometimes Lyme Regis, which is about sort of 45 minutes from us. So it's just about doable before the kids start going bananas.
I think if they know there's a beach at the end of
it. Yeah, exactly. And even on a winter's day, you know, they like, we go all year round, you know, and even on a colder day, there's still lots of fun to be had, you know, running from the waves. And there tends to be a treat for them at the end of it, whether it be a hot chocolate or an ice cream, depending on the season. So that keeps them motivated.
In the last couple of years, you've returned to Somerset because you spent the first years of your life here, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I for quite a good chunk, actually. Well, I spent the first 5 years of my life in Yeovil, which I was a bit too young to remember it, to be honest. We were in Yeovil itself. My dad worked at the hospital. And I didn't sort of understand, you know, as I was very little. But Yeovil gets a bit of a funny rep these days. But obviously, I remember it as, you know, like my sort of first childhood home and going to the swimming baths and things like that. And then after that, we moved to Dorset, to a little place called Martinstown, which is just near Dorchester. And then when I went to secondary school, we moved to Yorkshire. In a way, I've kind of gone full circle because after secondary school, I went to university in Manchester, then lived in London for a big chunk of time. And then, you know, when I hit 40, more or less, we came back to the Southwest. So, it's kind of been a big tour of the UK, more or less.
During those kind of growing up years, did you do much of that exploring of the area with your family? Was it sort of trips down to the coast?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when up to the age of five, my memories are quite hazy, but I can definitely remember. I remember our garden on Penn Hill in Yeovil, if anyone knows the town. And I just remember having a steep garden that was kind of stepped down and kind of running up and down with my brother and going to the swimming baths. And now I take my kids there myself, so it's quite a funny feeling. And I remember Nine Springs as well. I can remember sledging down Nine Springs in Yeovil on a couple of snowy years. So it is quite odd to be back in the area. because actually I'd kind of, not I don't have any bad memories of that part of my life at all, but in a way I'd kind of parked it and put it away because, you know, my life had gone elsewhere. It had gone to Dorset, it had gone to Harrogate in Yorkshire, you know, then I'd had this chunk of time in London. And if you'd said to me any time up until about 2 years ago, 3 years ago maybe, will I be back in Somerset in 2023, I would have said, of course not, no way. But actually, to be back here now, and actually to be in, you know, back in Somerset feels kind of slightly surreal in a way. It's still kind of sinking in, you know, for my wife and I as well. You know, we're sometimes we have to pinch ourselves. I mean, it's such an incredible place to be, particularly, as I said, going up to Ham Hill or driving across, you know, the Levels, or, you know, there's some really unique and beautiful places. And then, of course, there's a really kind of normal, mundane places like the swimming baths in Yeovil. And it all kind of, you know, it's a very interesting roundabout way of coming back to where I once was.
I read that food played quite a big part in family life for yeah. you. What was a typical scene around the dinner table?
I mean, I've got very sort of vivid memories, actually, of my parents cooking. I've got loads of food memories, as I suppose lots of people who are involved in food and otherwise do. My dad was a keen, I guess, more of a kind of a chef than perhaps my mum, who was a bit more of a cook. My dad was trained in the Cordon Bleu cooking school, although he didn't actually work as a chef in his adult life. He worked in hospitality, but before moving into, as I said, he worked in healthcare. But I remember my dad making bread on the weekends. I remember my mum making crumble from gooseberries and rhubarb that we had growing in our garden. I can remember, this is when we lived in Dorset actually, but I vividly remember, I was probably six or seven at the time, but I heard her sort of talking downstairs. I'd gone to bed. I went downstairs and it was my parents' friend, John Grindle, who has a really good food kind of blog and Instagram, actually, West Dorset foodie. And he'd come round with some trout, rainbow trout that he'd caught. But I heard this commotion downstairs and I thought to myself, God, what's going on? Like, what's happened? And then he got downstairs and there was a bag of fish on the kitchen table. And, you know, so we went off and I don't know what we made with it, trout pate or something like that. And, you know, had trout for dinner the next day or whatever. So yeah, there was always cooking going on. My mum cooked most things from scratch, apart from the occasional ham, egg and chips, which was also delicious. Yeah, so I think I was kind of always around food, and the sort of concept of cooking felt quite familiar, even though I obviously didn't, you know, start cooking myself. You know, I kind of cooked, you know, in a playful way with my parents. But yeah, it was definitely a big part of my life growing up, and has undoubtedly contributed to my career in restaurants that I have forged since.
You talk about your career in restaurants. You also had a previous career in the world of marketing, both of which have quite a kind of creative skew on them. Did you have an outlet for that creativity as a kid?
I mean, I guess I've always been quite creative, and it's definitely the thing that drives me in hospitality. You know, the kind of act of creating things without wanting to sound completely pretentious is something that I get a kick out of ultimately. And when I, you know, whether it be, I don't know, making some pasta or cooking a dish or plating up, or, you know, any element of cooking, even the composition of ingredients and how they go together and the balance of seasoning and whatnot feels like quite a kind of creative process. And it's one of the things I get most excited about ultimately. And I think it's probably one of the reasons why food culture has become so prominent in recent years, as the world has become slightly more detached and you're kind of on your screens and you're slightly more removed from work and, you know, life, and in a kind of remote working way, food has become an outlet for kind of creativity and hands-on touch and feel. And and I'm no different to that. I definitely sort of follow that trend. And I think, to kind of link back to your, you know, the first part of your question, I would say that in a way I kind of became interested in food in parallel with becoming disinterested with my previous career. There's a lot of great things to be said about I wouldn't, this isn't me saying I don't want to be disparaging about anyone who works in marketing, absolutely not. But for me personally, you know, it's not something I could get massively excited about. There were elements of it that I really liked, and I was, I suppose I was kind of in the, well, I was in the strategy department, so kind of more of the sort of business problem solving than actually coming up with the creative. And I wondered, I often thought back to myself and thought, if I had been in the kind of creative department, would I still be in that career? Perhaps I would. But, you know, life panned out as it did. But yeah, it's interesting. As I became sort of disenfranchised with the, how do I put this, BS, basically, that defines that industry. I was trying to think of a more eloquent way of putting it, but I couldn't, sorry. I sort of started to, I kind of returned to cooking because it's something that I'd done in my late teens to kind of earn pocket money, basically, and, you know, pay my way through uni. And it felt like a real antidote to this kind of quite corporate, quite sort of detached world of like brands. And you know, cooking was sort of the antithesis of that, in that to kind of get anything past these big brands and to get anything through the agency, even, you know, there was a kind of big chain of command. And likewise on the client side, the same thing. And it kind of felt you were moving at a bit of a snail's pace, even when there was urgency. Cooking felt so immediate and so just so hands-on, you know, that kind of instant creation of a dish from, you know, even if you're just cooking a pasta sauce at home, there's something about taking an onion, some garlic, tin of tomatoes, some oregano or whatever else you're going to put in it, a splash of balsamic vinegar, the simplest of things, and turning it into something that's really delicious, that has depth of flavor and that has body and, you know, that has a balance of acidity and sweetness. And that's just, there's something so, just so sort of beautiful about that, really. Just sort of gratifying, I think. I find it really easy to get excited about food in that way because you're, well, it's sort of sorcery to a degree. It's pun intended, I suppose. You know, there's been a bit of a sort of rise in the crafts as a career, or potentially like a sort of second career, or, you know, kind of hobbyism. Things like Etsy, platforms like that, that kind of allow you to kind of reach lots of small craftspeople who are doing lots of really cool things, whether it be ceramicists or woodworkers or, I don't know, arts. You know, I guess what I feel about cooking and food is what has driven all of those people to kind of pursue their craft as well. And I sort of feel like that it's a societal thing as well, you know. I feel like it's sort of society saying, I need to get my kicks, you know, I need to get my kicks out of what I'm doing. You know, I need to be satisfied.
We might get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah. One thing I did want to pick up was, you mentioned that your father was formally trained in sort of this is a cordon bleu style, whereas your experience, I believe, was picked up more kind of on the job.
Yeah,
in different places. Is that quite common in your profession, and how has that shaped your style and the way in which you approach food?
It's a very good question. I think it absolutely has shaped my style and my approach to cooking. And I think there's kind of two schools of chefs in a way. There's your kind of, it's interesting to compare chefs who've been to college and had kind of formal training or done apprenticeships and worked their way up through the ranks of under one person, and those who haven't. And I'm not saying that either is better or worse. And sometimes I kind of think to myself, oh, you know, imagine if I'd gone and had some formal training somewhere. I mean, I was a little bit old. I felt like I was a little bit old to do that at the time, although in hindsight, I probably wasn't. But actually, I kind of picked up all that stuff just through sort of osmosis, basically. And in fact, there's still things that I'm kind of learning or perfecting, certainly. Well, and I'm sure I will be forever, you know. I'm never going to be the perfect specimen of anything, let alone cooking. But I do think it presents sort of two paths. And one thing I will say, and I read a really interesting quote the other day, which I'll have to paraphrase, I can't remember it exactly, but there was a brilliant musician, music producer called Andrew Weatherall. Music's the other thing that I'm really excited about. Andrew Weatherall, for anyone who's listening, was a DJ and producer who died 3 years ago. And it was sort of the 3-year anniversary of his death the other day. And he produced the Primal Scream album, Screamadelica, which was a kind of genre defining in that era and forever, but also kind of career defining for him as well, and kind of catapulted him into something, you know, in this kind of revered state of being truly exceptional at what he did. But he said that he was just winging it. And he had this quote that was something along the lines of the confidence of ignorance, i.e. he didn't know what he was doing wrong, so wasn't afraid of the mistakes. And I feel like at points in my career, I've kind of taken that approach as well, you know, for better or worse. Whereas I think if you know the rules, breaking them can be quite scary. And again, that doesn't just apply to cooking. That applies to everything. Whereas I suppose there's a certain empowerment in the freedom of not being confined in particular parameters. And obviously you do need, you know, that there's kind of, there is the canon which sort of defines cooking and other crafts, I'm sure. And it's really good to have a basic understanding of them. In fact, it's essential, really. But I think also that having broader parameters has been useful for me.
You mentioned earlier on that your mum was more of a cook and your dad was just more of a chef. I suppose in my mind, as a outsider but someone who loves food, there is a bit of a difference between when you are cooking for your family or you're going out to eat and you want to sort of be taken on a bit of an experience. So for me, I see the role of someone like yourself as a chef is to sort of showing me something that I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go to a restaurant and order something that I can cook myself. I'm just wondering kind of if that's a philosophy that you bring to a plate or when you're designing menus, or the sort of experience that you want people to have when they are eating your food.
Yeah, in many ways it's quite a contentious, or the semantics of it are potentially contentious. Bit of a mouthful that. But in fact, we had a conversation in the kitchen the other day, and one of my team members said that he would be offended if he was called a cook. Whereas I'm not sure I would. In fact, I was kind of thinking to myself as he said it, like, would I call myself a chef or would I call myself a cook? I kind of straddle the two in a way. And I think as I'm becoming more comfortable in my own skin and my own career, as I kind of get older and mature into the professional that I have become, rather than, you know, when I was a bit earlier on in my career and kind of looking ahead to what I thought I would be, that there is a really interesting semantic difference between the two of those words, chef and cook. And they mean so much to so many people. But you're absolutely right. I think the chef, the word chef sort of denotes a kind of professional craft and skill and finesse and precision and all of those things, which kind of feel much more linked to restaurants and professional cookery and, tasting menus and all of those kind of things, or, you know, fine dining potentially. And whereas cook feels like you could say, one would say that their mum was a great cook, or we're going round to my uncle's for Christmas Day, he's a great cook. So I think there's a really important difference that people kind of make those assumptions in their own mind. But you will find professional quote unquote chefs who would describe themselves as cooks. And actually a lot of those people are people that I really admire. For example, Margot Henderson is someone who I worked with earlier on in my career and incidentally is opening up in Somerset relatively soon. But I'm sure I've heard her refer to herself as a cook rather than a chef. And, you know, lots of people who are brilliant, inspiring figures in the world of food would describe themselves more as a cook than as a chef. I mean, Gil Meller is another one who we are going to be doing an event with very soon. He would certainly describe himself as a cook rather than a chef. And I don't think that either of those two labels needs to have a greater or lesser weight than the other in a way. But I think it's more about kind of this sort of, the kind of craft skills are associated to the word chef, whereas more of a kind of learnt and felt experience becomes associated to cook.
Mm.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. One of the things I suppose unites both of those words is that love of ingredients.
Yeah.
And kind of thinking about, okay, well, this is a particular ingredient, or this is a food type that I love, or it's where it's come from, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And I have read in a number of your previous interviews a kind of love of foraging,
yeah,
as well. Is that something you've always been a fan of?
Actually, I mean, it's something that I brought to my professional career as soon as I kind of shifted from my old career in marketing into my new career in food. And I think actually it probably went hand in hand with that topic I was talking about earlier on, about kind of feeling disconnected to I guess like the kind of the work I was doing in marketing, and the ability to kind of forage, I suppose, possibly in lieu of having a kind of garden that was big enough to grow my own stuff back then. But given that I lived in a flat in East London, when I sort of first changed my career. So actually foraging was something that I could do even in a city to bring a kind of my own kind of unique spin on dishes and ingredients to the supper clubs and stuff that I was involved in right back in the early days, whether it be elderflower, whether it be damsons or crab apples that you can find everywhere. You know, you don't have to be in the countryside to find, you know, they grow in cities up and down the country. So it was something that I guess allowed me to feel even more connected to the food that I was producing from the get-go. And you're right, I think that kind of notion of, it kind of fueled a search for, provenance, I suppose, in my food that has been quite defining, I guess. It's something that, you know, I love exotic flavours and exotic ingredients, although I don't use them particularly, you know, a huge amount, but, you know, I love yuzu as much as the next person, for example, or wasabi. But, you know, give me a tomato in season, or, you know, elderflowers in June in a cordial or whatever, or turn it into a granita or something like that, and that makes me really, really happy, you know. I think that sense of, I guess it's a kind of connection. It kind of goes back to that idea of having a connection to the food that I am cooking, and it having relevance to me, and that, I suppose, giving a kind of underpinning the story that I'm trying to tell with my food. Because ultimately food it's evocative. It's like it speaks to people beyond just the flavors, you know. And I think when cooks or chefs, you know, get it right, it's because their dishes have integrity, you know, they believe in them, they put their heart and soul into them. And I've said a number of times that, and you know, I guess it's a bit of a cliche in a way, but you can kind of taste the love in dishes when it's been put in. There can be a bit of a danger of, you know, potentially some of those more kind of high-end fine dining establishment, it can feel a little bit like cooking by numbers. And actually, I think when you eat someone's food where they've put their heart and soul into it, whether it be fine dining, whether it be Nonna in Italy or you know, at your nan's house or whatever it might be, you can taste the love. And I think that's what makes food special. And I suppose, yeah, my use of kind of foraged ingredients or seasonal ingredients is something that completes the picture of the food that I'm trying to put out there to the world, really.
A couple of really interesting points that you made that I want to pick up on. First is the sort of seasonality and the ability to take things that are ripe and fresh and here and now and, you know, convert them into a great plate of food. How difficult is that at this time of year?
Yeah, it's a little bit more difficult. It's February as we're recording this, and at the moment there's almost nothing in season, really. We try, particularly at home, more so at home than any of our other restaurants, we try to be quite kind of closely focused on what's in season here in this locality in order to kind of give our food, I suppose, like, you know, give it context ultimately. And that kind of principle is quite common these days in a lot of restaurants, not necessarily to the point of localism to that degree, but obviously being in Somerset as we are, it's a real hotbed of growers and producers, and there's a number of very, very small scale growers and sort of farmers that we work with and some larger farmers that we work with in the area as well. But at the moment, there's very little growing, ultimately. This is what they call the hungry gap. It's not my favourite term, if I'm completely honest with you, but I do. But the principle of it is really powerful, because actually we've got this market garden that we work with in Merriott's, which is about 3 or 4 miles away. And at the moment, the only thing that they're growing is a particular very hardy type of kale, which is very bitter when you have to cook it quite a lot to take away the bitterness. And then the stuff that they've got kind of stored, so carrots, celeriac, and then basically pumpkins that are kind of curing in their shed or whatever. So there's very little around. Obviously, there are other places in the UK where things are growing, rhubarb being one of the ones that I get really excited about at this time of year. That there's the Yorkshire rhubarb triangle, where rhubarb is grown in darkness to give it that beautiful pink colour. But we definitely find ourselves at this year looking a little bit further afield, and we've got Italian bitter leaves on our menu, for example, Puntarella and Radicchio di Treviso. And we have Spanish blood oranges on our menu at the moment, for example, as well. Because, you know, I think to build a menu around pumpkin, celeriac and kale, you could do something delicious, but I think the chefs would all go a bit mad, basically. We'd all go crazy. And we might not get that much repeat business, because once you've eaten that menu once between, you know, January and March, you might not fancy coming back. So this is a time when we kind of broaden our horizons slightly.
The other thing you mentioned previously was that food should be about the integrity of the dish and be able to taste the love that you mentioned of the person who's created it. It should bring joy, it should bring happiness, it should bring people together. And for the most part, that is true. But at the moment, you scratch the surface of the food industry, and there's some quite big cultural, political shifts that are impacting where and how we get our food. How do you sort of square that with the type of story that you're looking to tell your customers?
That is a very good question. I think to sort of kind of go back to what I said before about having integrity and sort of having context for the food that we're cooking, I suppose those sort of principles are the things that define what I want this restaurant home specifically to be, but certainly would apply to the other restaurants that I'm involved in, Larry's and the Van in London. But I think, you know, having a kind of principle of sustainability is really important, and sustainability is a sort of, it can become a bit of a meaningless buzzword. And I think it's really important to just keep a bit of a sort of relativism about that, and just kind of do what's in your means, whether it be in the business or at home. And, you know, not everything is practical for everybody, but for us here at home, that means it means a couple of things. It means obviously looking to source all of our ingredients as ethically as we can. And by ethically, I kind of mean with the least impact upon our environment, but also the people who are growing it. Traceability is the kind of key thing, really, for me. And that's something that I follow quite closely at work and at home, as in my home cooking. You know, I think if you know where your food is coming from, that is the first step to it being sustainable and ethical. So if you know that the pork you're buying is from a pig that is reared by, you know, a farmer up the road, and you know it's slaughtered at, we've just had two sheep carcasses come in this morning actually, and I know exactly where they were reared. I know the guy who owns the farm on first name terms. I know the farmer on first name terms as well. I know where they were. I know the abattoir where they were killed. In fact, we went to the farm earlier on this year, and we saw the flock of sheep that they came from. And, you know, it's kind of easy to think of meat as being not sustainable because of the environmental impact, which I kind of agree with. But also I would say that if you know where it's from and you kind of have trust in the people who are rearing it, and the process it takes from ultimately going from the field where it lives to to being on your plate, that for me is a pretty brilliant first step. You know, this is not about like bashing big organizations, fast food chains or anyone like that, but if your burger costs you £1.50, the chances are there's going to be a lot of squeezing along the line, from the growing, the rearing of the animal, through to the, you know, taking it to slaughter, through to the production process, through to getting it on your plate. And, you know, there'll be many, many layers in that. If a guest comes and has this sheep on the menu tomorrow, they will know that it's come from Otter Valley Farm, which is, you know, just down the road in the Blackdown Hills. And, you know, we can tell them all about it. So I think that's brilliant. You know, it's a brilliant step. And likewise with the veg, yes, we're buying blood oranges from Spain at the moment. We're buying Treviso from Northern Italy. But in the main, we source our ingredients incredibly locally. And we have in the most part, we have a personal connection to the people who grow our food, i.e. we know them on first name terms, which is really wonderful. And I think that's the sort of first step in kind of reaching a level of sustainability that we're comfortable with in terms of the sourcing of our ingredients and the provenance. Then there's another whole stream of it, which is about kind of working sustainably whilst we're here. So obviously step one is kind of minimizing our waste. So not buying in products that come in with unnecessary packaging, asking our suppliers to give us reusable cartons and things like that. So our fish suppliers, we ask them not to bring us the disposable polystyrene containers. We have special reusable plastic cartons. Obviously, we have a garden, so we're composting, and so there's kind of like circular sort of cyclical process to our waste, which so we will start feeding our compost, which will go into the raised beds, which will use to grow our ingredients. And then there's a whole other side of sustainability, which I suppose is maybe slightly broader, which is about the team. The hospitality industry in general it's had a terrible reputation for generations, actually. And only now in 2023 are we kind of reaching a bit of an awakening with how the industry operates in terms of its sort of interpersonal communication and even to what is asked of team members, making sure that our team are first of all listened to and heard is really important. I think that's kind of step one for us, making sure that we are sympathetic to the necessities of life outside of the kitchen is essential. And I think it's something, it sounds so obvious, but I think that's something that has been quite detached from the world of professional cookery up until very, very recently, apart from in a, you know, handful of kitchens, you know, making sure that people have the opportunity to kind of do stuff outside of work rather than just being worked to the bone for 6 days a week. And so they're so exhausted that all they can do on the other day is do their washing, you know. And I think 10 years ago in fine dining, that was probably quite commonplace. Our team work a 4 day week. So it's kind of 3 long days and 1 shorter day. So it's still a long, the hours they work are long, but at least they have 3 full days to kind of do other stuff. So, you know, a day to recover and 2 days to spend with friends and family. It tends to be that our team are relatively young. You know, there's certainly team members with family, and we're kind of sympathetic to their needs in terms of childcare and so on. I have kids myself, and that's really front of mind for me. I think there's a sort of sense of the kind of winds of change are kind of sweeping through the industry, and I think it's not before time. And one thing I will say is that the economics of the industry will take a while to catch up with the change that is absolutely necessary. And if you think about other service industries, well, I think the service industry is sort of split into two camps. You've got hospitality and healthcare on one side, which are kind of incredibly overworked, and then you have at the other end of the spectrum service industries like law and, you know, those kind of professional services where the economics are so entirely different. And I use this example all the time, but we recently bought a house, and to get our lawyers to sign a piece of paper would cost you about £500. If you came and sat at the kitchen counter at home and spent maybe £100 a head on a full all-out tasting menu experience, you'd see three chefs, you know, or three or four chefs sometimes, you know, grafting pretty hard for the duration of your meal, which could be sort of three and a half hours. So where does that, where does that £100 sit in terms of your perception of value versus your, the lawyer who's signing a piece of paper for £500? I'm not saying that the £500 isn't worth it, and I'm not saying that their professional qualifications don't necessitate that price point, but I am saying that people need to think carefully when they kind of say that, you know, generally speaking, we have incredible feedback, but now and again, you know, you get the odd person saying, oh, it's too expensive. But you look at the processes that are required and the time and the physical energy that's required to put all of the food that we create on a plate and serve them and clean them and do the washing up and relay the table and, you know, print the menu and the whole picture. And suddenly it's like, well, how do we do it? I'm shocked that we can even do it for the price we do it, you know. And actually, I think there will be there kind of has to be a bit of an economic shift in the hospitality industry, because I do think that people that the team members still need to be paid more. We pride ourselves on paying fairly, but I'd love to be able to give everyone a, you know, 5-10 grand pay rise if I could, myself included. In order for that to happen, there will need to be a bit of a kind of perception shift amongst people who eat out. Because I think ultimately our understanding of value in restaurants is kind of set by the prices that were kind of being, that were kind of put in place, I don't know, like maybe sort of 5-10 years ago. Mm. And the world is changing so quickly. And I think, it might require, and I think that will kind of be a shift that in my generation of restaurateurs, we're going to have to really kind of work really hard to catch up with. Big topic.
Earlier on, you said that you weren't expecting to be down in Somerset at this point in your life. So how did the idea for Holme first appear?
In many ways, it was the opportunity to open a restaurant here kind of came to me, if I'm completely honest with myself. And my wife would say that we manifested it, because we were chatting earlier on about our lives before moving to Somerset, you and I. We were in South London and previously East London, having a great time, you know, enjoying ourselves, living, doing all the things you would do if you lived in Zone 2 London. I was obviously working really hard in the restaurants and doing all the things that sort of city life affords, you know, art, culture, going out, seeing mates, going to galleries and stuff. I mean, maybe a little bit less so since I had kids, but, you know, sort of really enjoying being in a city and having that as my sort of, you know, my life kind of revolving around that way of living. But there was one really big problem that we just couldn't find a solution for, and that was ultimately that we couldn't afford a house. Therefore, we had this sort of sense of instability, and had our first child, and then we had another on the way, and, you know, that sort of sense of being a renter with two children, well, three, two of my own and a stepdaughter, you know, was a real I guess, like, it brought about quite a lot of anxiety, if I'm completely honest with you. And I know lots of people are in that situation in London, but probably other cities as well around the UK. But we wanted to move somewhere else where we could have a sort of safe and secure home for our family of five that we owned. And so we're kind of looking elsewhere in the UK. And my parents, as I said, are in Dorset. So we're kind of looking to the southwest as somewhere we wanted to go. But also, being that my restaurants were in South London, it was a bit of a conundrum. Like, how do we make this opportunity, but not put myself out of a job in the process? And lo and behold, I kind of got an email out of the blue. It was in January 2020, I think it was. So kind of in the midst of the pandemic, from a friend of a friend saying, hi, we don't know each other very well, but I'm involved in this project to renovate an old building in this lovely village called South Petherton. We're looking for someone to run a restaurant there. Would you be interested? And I was kind of like, hold on, like, this is sort of what we've been talking about. So pitched it to my partner and was like, look, you know, I've been thinking about going to maybe Dorset or Devon or Cornwall or something like that. Well, how about Somerset? And Somerset had kind of, it was already, I mean, Somerset's a wonderful place and has been forever, but the kind of rumblings of this food explosion were kind of happening, or in the midst of happening, if not kind of happened in the way they have now. So we'd kind of heard about, so a friend of mine, Merlin, opened OSIP in Bruton. Everyone knows about it. It's absolutely fantastic. I think it had, well, it was lockdown. So we were all kind of doing takeaway meal boxes and stuff at that point in time. But Merlin, is an incredibly talented and celebrated chef. And so I kind of caught wind of what he was doing in Bruton. I'd heard a little bit about that area. But I also knew that lots of other, there's a handful of other restaurants that I'd heard about as well. But crucially, I knew that it was a place where there's lots of incredible producers and people doing great things with, raw ingredients, ultimately. We'd always stocked Borough Hill cider brandy at all of our restaurants since the beginning. And I suppose one of the things that really made me sort of sit up and take notice, well, I looked on the map and then I saw that Borough Hill was like 3 miles away. And I was like, oh, it's right next to Borough Hill. And they're people, they're an organisation that I really respected and love their product. And we just thought maybe this is kind of coming together. And we came down and met the owners of the building. They brought along with them a flask of tea and some hot venison sausages and a perfectly ripe Baron Bigold cheese. And we sat upstairs in the site office of the building site as it was then, and chatted about the potential, and they were lovely people, and we just thought to ourselves, this is kind of too good to be true, but let's just go for it. My wife was 3 months pregnant at the time with our second child, and they sort of said, she was due in July, and they were like, we want to open in August, and we were like, that's not going to happen. but we, those kind of things always take a little bit longer. And actually, the build took longer than they initially thought. And we ended up opening in the follow. So we opened in November, actually. So we had the baby. We had Marvi moved out of London 2 weeks later into rented accommodation in Odcombe. Opened the restaurant in November, so that whole period was like a real whirlwind of like giving birth, moving house, opening a restaurant, relocating, settling the other two kids into their schools and preschools, settling ourselves into this completely new life, realizing that we didn't know anyone, but we had a couple of mates actually, but suddenly we had this like whole group of people who we were kind of introduced to through the restaurant. And yeah, it was a real kind of complete, it was a whirlwind. It was a real whirlwind. And I wouldn't change it, but it was quite intense. It was quite an intense period of life. And as anyone who's got kids knows that, having a child is, like that kind of act of like giving birth and kind of settling into a new life with a new baby is one of the biggest and most, don't want to say challenging, but it's like it kind of turns your life upside down in a way that nothing else ever will. And so to kind of do all of those things whilst, kind of settling into life as a family of five rather than four was huge, basically. But we came out I feel like we're out the other side of that now. Marvi is 18 months and our other two are 3 and 11 respectively. We're kind of feeling pretty settled into our new life here in Somerset.
Yeah.
The restaurant is kind of approaching 18 months old now. And we feel like we are kind of very much, we're bedding in, if not completely, the foundations are set for what lies ahead, basically.
In one of the interviews before opening, you talked about bringing some of the excitement and cosmopolitanism of London restaurants here.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something that you've achieved, or something that actually maybe you've changed what the emphasis of here is?
Interesting. Yeah, I actually, funnily enough, I was sort of dwelling on that for some reason the other day, and I feel like there was a bit of naivety in that, to be quite honest with you. And I wonder if that was perhaps something that, as a local person, might have read that and kind of been, it's potentially quite a polarizing comment. And I think, if I'm honest with myself, that was a slightly naive and potentially quite ignorant thing to say. people make mistakes, and I don't know if people were necessarily offended by that. But I'm not distancing myself from it either, because I think I believed in what I was saying at the time. But I think it was coming from a place of not trying to create a country restaurant, because I didn't feel like that's what I knew. And I didn't feel like that's where my strength was. Mm. And I felt like my strength actually was in having restaurants in Brixton and Peckham, which have a unique energy to them. And I think I kind of wanted to bring that experience, if you like, to Somerset, rather than saying, oh, you know, let's open a restaurant in a country house in Somerset. Not, you know, this isn't a country house. It's a bank. It's an old bank in a village at the centre of quite a bustling, you know, fairly busy little village actually. And I think that's probably what informed that approach. And if we had, you know, if for example in a parallel universe we had landed ourselves in with a small holding, or we landed ourselves operating a restaurant in a country house. There's many brilliant places across the country that do that. And I think, you know, that would have set the parameters quite differently. With Holm, we wanted to do something that kind of had the energy of Levan and Salon, ultimately. Less so Larry's, because Larry's is quite a different concept. But, you know, Levan and Salon, particularly, very much driven by the seasons and very much driven by provenance. But ultimately, they're kind of neighbourhood restaurants that you go to, you know, as kind of a, they kind of play the part of a night out in London. You know, the music's quite loud and there's loads of delicious wines and cocktails to choose from. And, you know, we offer a kind of an a la carte menu and a tasting menu. And we kind of wanted it to be a place that you could come and have that buzz, you know, rather than a quiet, starchy tablecloth kind of experience that you might sort of associate with a country house hotel restaurant. And I think we have achieved that, but I think we've also, in the process of settling in for a year and a half, as we have been, you know, we've started to understand what our guests want. And I think in the most part, the guests understand what we're trying to achieve. But there's definitely people who are like, oh, the chairs are too hard, or the music's too loud, or why are there no tablecloths? Or, and, you know, it tends to be that those comments come from a slightly older demographic, ultimately. And I suppose part of this process of running a restaurant, you know, in the kind of hospitality, you're kind of creating the correct experience for your guests within your means. So, you know, there are times when we have to turn the music down, and we there are slightly, you know, there are some seats that are slightly more comfortable than others, and we have really lovely Ercole chairs, but they have ultimately, they're a wooden base, and if you're sitting on it for 2.5 hours, then, you know, sometimes a cushion is quite nice. But we have got some other padded seats as well. But I think it's important to understand what your guests want from the experience, and as much as you can to try and, you know, deliver that. If you know, and I have found myself as time has gone by, I've kind of, you know, I've been conscious of trying to create. You know, it's not like the me show. It's about them. You know, it's about their. It's about their meal. You know, they want to come here and have a lovely meal with their, have a catch up with their family, or, you know, celebrate an anniversary, or, you know, just whatever, for whatever reason they're coming to the restaurant. It's about them and it's about their experience. And I think there are restaurants that are very much about kind of, here's the experience that you're going to get in this establishment, particularly at a more kind of fine dining level. And there's a few that spring to mind that do that exceptionally well. In a kind of quite sort of uncompromising way, undoubtedly very comfortable and with excellent service, but you know, you're kind of going there for one thing and one thing only. Whereas I want Holm to feel a bit more inclusive than that, and we have a very sort of accessible set menu, which hopefully is quite affordable in the most part. You know, it's never going to be a kind of you know, an everyday thing. But, you know, we want to kind of be accessible to people who want to come a couple of times a month. But then we also have our sort of tasting menu, which is a bit more suited to perhaps to, you know, this kind of blowout big occasions, whether it be an anniversary or a big birthday or something like that. So, yeah, another long answer.
You mentioned earlier on you've got some chefs coming in to provide a bit of a different experience, different menu. Uh-huh. What else are you excited about?
Yeah, we've got loads going on this year, actually. As I said, we are 18 months into opening the restaurant. So we're sort of settling in, and we've kind of, you know, the first year was always going to be, I think in any new business, is always about kind of feeling your way and working out kind of where you sit in the landscape and that kind of thing. But now, as we kind of go through into the next part of our life cycle, we are sort of bedding in on a deep level. So we've got, as I said, we've got the collaboration series with some other chefs coming up. So we've got Gil Meller coming over on the 1st of March. We've got Harriet Mansell, who has a brilliant restaurant called Robin Wild in Lyme Regis. And then we've got Anna Ortiz, who was on your show the other week. And she is coming to cook a menu. She's from Galapagos, as you know. And so she'll be kind of putting a sort of Southern Latin American spin on our kind of local ingredients, which I'm really excited about. And then the final one of the series is Sam Lomas, who is head chef of Glebe House, which is an incredibly highly regarded guest house and small holding in Devon. So that's a kind of short term, that's sort of over spring. And then beyond that, we are going to be opening 7 bedrooms above the restaurant. So that's a huge project that we've been working on for most of last year. We've got 2 stories above us here, and we're going to have 7 ensuite bedrooms, 2 in the kind of loft, which will have a really cool kind of slightly more kind of modernist feel. And then on the first floor, there's another 5 bedrooms, which will kind of riff off the more kind of period architecture of the building a little bit more. And we have been doing the build for that, as I say, over the course of last year. But we're also going to be launching a Kickstarter campaign in the coming weeks to help fund the kind of finishing touches, if you like. So there's going to be some incredible rewards available, some of which are sort of money can't buy things. So we're going to have some opportunities to buy rewards such as private dining in your own home. We've got some outdoor dining experiences as well. And then we've also got vouchers that people can pre-purchase that are redeemable across all of our restaurants. So both Levan and Larry's in London and Holm in Somerset as well. So there seems like there's loads going on. We've also got the garden outside. And as I mentioned earlier on, we've been composting. And in fact, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be planting in our raised beds as well. For the first time, we're going to be using ingredients that we've grown ourselves, which I'm really excited about.
Nicholas, we're now going to play Somerset location or obscure movie title.
Okay.
doesn't have a catchy name, but this is the game where I'm going to give you a name and you have to decide whether you think it's a place in Somerset or the title of a film.
Okay.
So I've got 8 names, and the first one is Henan Chickens Field.
That's a place in Somerset.
It is a place in Somerset. It's in Wincanton.
Oh, good.
Just up the 303 from here. Number 2 is Hunter's Crossing.
I'm going to say film.
It is a film. Yeah.
Complete guess.
About a hunting competition. There we go. Number 3, Boozer Pit.
I'm going to say that is a place in Somerset.
It is a place in Somerset.
These are all guesses,
on a roll here,
by the way.
On a roll, 3 out of 3. Number 4, Iron Post.
Oh, I think that's a place as well, actually.
It is a place.
I'm making this up.
Massively
as I go
on a roll.
Yeah.
Number 5 is Footlight Parade.
Footlight Parade. I am going to say it's a place as well.
First one to get wrong, that is a film. From 1933, starring James Cagney.
I haven't seen it, I'm afraid.
All right, number 6 is Tobacco Road.
That's a tough one. I'm going to say place as well.
It's another film.
Oh.
It's a 1941 comedy set in rural Georgia.
Fair enough.
So, there we go. Number 7 is Lady Lawn.
That's got to be a place in Somerset.
It is a place in Somerset. And the last one is Middle of Nowhere.
I'm going to go with film.
That is film.
Yay!
It's 2008 with Susan Sarandon.
Very good actress.
So you got 6.
Not too bad.
Out of 8, which is pretty good. I don't think anyone's done better.
Fair enough.
So far.
Cool. Well, they were all guesses. So
that's good.
Neither been to or seen any of the films or places.
Before we go, where can people find out more about you and the restaurant?
They can follow us on social media. That's always a good one. Holme Somerset, or at Holme Somerset, or go to the website, which is holmesomerset.co.uk. I sort of try and keep a little bit up to date on my personal social media as well. So you can follow me. I'm just at Nicholas Balfe. But yeah, as I said, there's loads going on, and I feel like there's always stuff happening in the restaurant and the other restaurants as well. Actually, if anyone's in South London and fancies somewhere absolutely exceptional to eat, I can highly recommend both Levan and Larry's. But yeah, there's loads happening at Holme, and I feel like we sort of touched on some big topics and the potentially sort of scary place that society is in, but actually, I think we've got more to be excited about than to worry about in not just in my restaurant, but in the industry as a whole. And I think that I would encourage people to go and enjoy the restaurants that they like going to and have a good time and come and see us, and you'll certainly get a warm welcome and some good food and leave happy.
Nicholas, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been a great guest.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a real pleasure. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production, and music is provided by Jazzar under Creative Commons.